Bradford Bulls, live on Pulse 2.
Hi, I'm Mick the Game Caller Gleddell, and on this week's Bradford Bulls in Conversation, we're going to hear from this person.
Hi, I'm Jamie Langley, and this is my Bradford Bulls in Conversation.
I spoke to Bradford Bulls legend Jamie Langley about his illustrious playing career. What's it like to play in Grand Finals, World Club Challenge Finals and Challenge Cup Finals? We asked him about his toughest opponent, but first we asked Jamie Langley how the coronavirus is affecting him as the London Broncos assistant coach.
Yeah, I'd imagine we're in the same boat as most people, to be honest, mate. I think you're sort of led by the government guidelines, aren't you? So initially, we tried to get a head start on it. We did feel that the lockdown were going to be enforced, so we did try and get ahead of it a little bit in terms of us planning, trying to put some scheduling in place, some structures in place for the players. We managed to get access to the ground and the gymnasium so we could get as much equipment out as possible before the ground were to be locked down, because we knew that was probably going to happen in the foreseeable future. Obviously, it's a public venue, so they probably had no choice. So, yeah, we tried to get as much stuff out to the boys as possible, tried to get as much planning and scheduling in place as possible. But then, obviously, as it transpired and the furlough scheme came into play, we elected to do that as a club. It just made more sense financially. So once that happened, then, obviously, the contact with the players has to cease. And they just went on to a voluntary basis, mate. But fortunately, we've got a really good group who we've got a hell of a lot of trust in. And they are generally very, very good when left to their own devices. So although we are in touch with the players on an informal basis, just more from a welfare point of view, really, just keeping tabs, making sure everything's okay and they're all doing okay. But I'm sure, yeah, they're all ripping in and staying healthy should the time come. We're pretty confident as a staff that they'll all be ready. But for us as staff, it is very difficult because, again, it's like the blind leading the blind, really. You don't really know what's around the corner. So you can only try and be preemptive on it and try and foresee things that may occur and just be ready for it should they do so.
And, of course, the latest, certainly at our level, Bradford, London, Featherstone, Lee, is that the season potentially, Jamie, could be null and void because clubs currently, they've got a couple of weeks now where they can actually look at the finances and ultimately, you know, try and work out from a financial point of view if they can actually afford to restart the season. Because as you know, the minute you start training, you come off furlough, and if there's no, you know, there's no revenue coming in from supporters coming in the stadium through the turnstiles, you know, buying food and drink, hospitality, Championship Rugby League is going to struggle.
Yeah, it is. It's an incredibly difficult time. Obviously, you've got, as you mentioned there, you've got probably a handful of clubs who have probably got more at stake than others without being too disrespectful to other clubs in the competition. You've got some clubs there who, like ourselves, are operating a full-time organisation where we feel like we're right on the cusp of Super League. We proved that we're ready for that level of competition last year, albeit we lost a few players, but we feel like we've got a really strong squad together. The facilities and everything that we've got in place here at London, the infrastructure from scholarship through to reserves, we feel like we're a Super League club in the making there. We're ready to go. So for that to be taken off the table for us is obviously, it could be disastrous, really. As for Lee, Featherstone, those other teams who've invested a hell of a lot of money this year, who are vying for promotion. Now, I totally get it. When you look at it from an objective point of view, I can completely understand the part-time organisations who do rely heavily, as you say, on gate receipts and concessions and the like. It's a tough decision for them to come back to work and to go off the furlough scheme and then to potentially lose a hell of a lot of money with not much return or reward for it. Then where is the incentive for those clubs? So we totally get it. We can see from both sides of the argument. We're just trying to be as optimistic as possible and trying to think of as many potential different outcomes, positive outcomes for us that may occur, really. But as you say, that you're leaving it in the laps of the gods, really, in terms of the decision-making process. But all we can do is prepare the best we can. Should the best outcome prevail, then we're ready to go.
Well, I think for anybody who's listening to this, you know, we hope that the clubs, like I say, they've got to be brutally honest in the projections that they submit to the RFL. And if the season, unfortunately, does get null and voided, then, you know, that certainly at Championship and League One level, you know, we've got to be in a real strong position to restart for next year because, as you know, Jamie, the Rugby League World Cup is being held in this country next year. And I think it's real imperative that there's no disruption to that Rugby League World Cup.
Yeah, 100%. That's huge. But again, I think that's probably, as you say, that's looking ahead to next year. That's probably the least a lot of clubs worries at the minute. I think they'll just be trying to get the ducks in line, get the finances in order and just probably just trying to survive this crisis at this moment in time. But as you say, looking ahead to next year with the World Cup on the horizon, that's huge. And you can see that with the Super League clubs now stomping around, trying to get a plan together for them to restart. I think I saw the three potential different options with the start dates and the end dates and things like that. That's really promising. I think the Super League can get going. That's one massive hurdle overcome. But then, as you said, for the Division One and Championship clubs, you're facing a completely different battle there. So, yeah, it's going to be incredibly difficult for those clubs to get going, but they need to just put themselves in the strongest position possible. Should the worst case happen this year, then we're ready to go for next year.
Jamie, let's just take you back in the TARDIS 30 years. Let's take you back 30 years. Where did your rugby league journey begin? Obviously, we know you're from Normanton. Near Wakefield in Castleford in West Yorkshire, just on the doorstep from Bradford. Talk us through your rugby league journey. How did it all begin?
So, yeah, I started at Normanton, a really strong community club there in West Yorkshire. And it was my best friend, actually, next door neighbour. His dad were a massive Cass Tigers fan. And we're sort of split right down the middle. Where in Normanton, you either support Wakefield or you support Cass. And there's no in-between, really. It was around, as you say, we're right on that borderline. And my mate were a massive Cass fan, and they took me down to watch a reserves game, probably about 7 years old. And it was Cass reserves, and they just signed, I think, Richie Blackmore from over in New Zealand. They got Tony Kemp running about. They had a really strong team out that day. And I think they were playing Lee. I had no idea about rugby league and the colours. It was a bit of a cold night, so I put a scarf on to go. And as it happens, it was a red and white striped scarf. Lee colours, I had no idea. So my best mate's dad, he's like, you can't wear that. He wouldn't let me wear it. I was sat there absolutely freezing, sat in the stand watching my first game of rugby league. But that's what got me hooked. I just loved it. I loved the physical aspect of it, the speed of it. And then I asked my dad actually played for Leeds in a very successful Leeds team in the late 60s, early 70s. Fortunate enough to play at Wembley two or three times and represented Yorkshire. But he never really coerced me into playing rugby league. It was through my best mate who ended up going down and training at Normanton. I went down then and a few other mates from school. And that was it. I was hooked on the sport. I loved it. Loved going down. Loved the camaraderie. Loved being with my mates. Going down, training, kicking the ball about in an evening. And that's pretty much how I started out playing. And I remained at Normanton then until I was about, I think, 16 when I signed a professional contract with Bradford. And I remember my first game at Bradford with the academy. I had a GCSE English exam, I think at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then mum and dad had to race me over to Hull at the boulevard, as it were, then, and we were playing Hull Academy. So I had an exam in the afternoon, and then I had to go and boot up. And Daryl Shelford was the coach at the time. He just said, don't worry about warming up, just sit on bench, you'll be all right. Don't know if you'll get on or not. And then our loose forward, Tony Swift, got concussed in the first minute. So I got rushed straight onto the field, and that's pretty much how my journey began.
Just focusing on when you are 16, Jamie, obviously Bradford at that point, you know, they were one of the big four clubs along with Wigan, Saints and Leeds. Did you have any interest from any other clubs, and if there was interest from other clubs, what made you decided to sign with the Bradford Bulls?
It's a great question, is that, Mick? I remember those days really fondly. I was really fortunate to play in a very, very good community team at Normanton, and us probably alongside Milford at that time, who had Ryan Bailey, the likes of Bales, Richie Mathers, Dwayne Barker, who were a very good player. Craig Stanley went on to play at Leeds. Jermaine Ray had a very good career. Dean Ripley played at Cast a few times. They're a very good team. We had a good team at Normington as well. And it were always kind of us and Milford in the finals. So we had, you always had scouts out from all across the league watching every single game, really. And probably from when we were about 12 years old. I don't know how it operates now, but it was very different then. There were no scholarships in place, so you played with your amateur club, Normington. Then we play for Wakefield District or Cast Schoolboys. Then you play for Yorkshire versus Lancashire. And that was the epitome of the game at that age. And you did that all the way to 16. And there were no scholarships in place. So the highest level of rugby league in the country, under 16s, was the community clubs. It was a Normington versus Milford or a Hunslet Parkside versus Blackbrook. There were no scholarships then. Then you went on, and as I said before, you're playing with the academy under 18s at 15, 16 year old. That was the next stage. So you always had scouts out watching from a really young age. And a lot of my friends were getting touted from different clubs. And obviously, your Leeds, your Wakefields, your Castleford's, and Bradford were one of the top sides then, if not the top side. And because of our rivalry with Milford at that time, a lot of them lads were on the Leeds programme. So when you went on the Leeds training scholarship programmes and things like that, you're always kind of mixing with these lads, and there's always a bit of a rivalry there. And our team, our players, seemed to gravitate towards Bradford for whatever reason. But I think the main reasons, Mick, were that, I mean, they were a massive club, Bradford. It's huge. And there were some really, really good people there working for the club. I remember Eric Hawley were the chief scout there. They had Kevin Maguire. And they'd come to every single game. They'd spend time with mum and dad. They became really good family friends, even at a young age. So I remember they used to invite us through as young lads at 14, 15 year old to Oddsall to watch a Bradford Leeds derby or to watch Bradford play Saints on a Friday night in front of 15,000 fans. And it just felt like home immediately. They made you feel welcome. They'd invite you up for a meal before and after the game. They made your mum and dad feel part of it. And from that moment on, you just felt like a Bradford Bull. And I loved it, if I'm honest. I just couldn't see myself going anywhere. I never wanted to go to Lancashire, obviously, with the travel. It had been quite a big burden for my parents to have to commit to that. And Bradford just felt like home immediately, as I say. It were the people, it were the buzz that you got around the place. I mean, you experienced it, mate. You grew up supporting Bradford from a young age. If you could take people now who are new to rugby league and turn back the clock 20 years, and you take them to a balmy Friday night and summer's night in Oddsall with 15, 20,000 people there, you had the speedway, the monster trucks going round, you had the flamenco dancers, you had the tribute acts, the music. It were unbelievable. I mean, the way it were then, I reckon that would transcend any. I mean, Warrington did a very good job last year with the entertainment side, but they probably want to patch on what Bradford were doing 20, 25 years ago. They were so far ahead of the game. It were unbelievable. And just that whole experience, it just swept me away. I just loved it. And from about probably 14, 15, that's all I ever wanted to do, or go and play for Bradford Bulls.
Who was your first sort of boyhood hero? Who was the first player that you modelled yourself on and you thought, I want to be like this particular player out on the field?
Again, a very good question. You probably gravitate and relate towards players who play in your position, I suppose. So when I watched in Super League at that time, it would have been Andy Farrell playing at loose forward. I used to love watching Adrian Morley play at Leeds in the second row. When you watch Bradford play, they had some very, very good players. Obviously, Meadows, Paul Medley played back row. He had a bit of pace. Chris Joint, again, another second row with a little bit of pace. And that's kind of what my game was, really, at a young age. I were a running back row. I used to like playing out wide and use my pace a little bit as well. So they were the players that I used to really look forward to seeing play. And then when I did eventually sign for Bradford and you get a glimpse of that environment and you get to work with some of the first-team players, I spent a lot of time with Paul Anderson and Lee Radford. Obviously, Baloo lived in the same town as me in Normington, and Radders travelled over from Hull at that time. So I used to hop in and get a lift with them lads when I first started out training with the first team. And I learned a lot from them as well. So you kind of look up to those players as mentors as well, because you're spending so much time with them on the road as travel partners and everything else, and you pick so much up from them. I mean, I was blessed, really, in that Bradford team. There were so many great characters, great leaders, that you were never stuck for anyone to turn to advice from.
You've just mentioned mentors. Probably the... Certainly as a Bradford Bulls, Bradford Northern fan, Jamie, I'll always remember Mike Forshaw being like the 5 years prior to you, you know, ahead of you. How much did Mike Forshaw and having a player like Mike Forshaw around you help you? Because ultimately you were the natural successor to his throne in that loose forward position.
Yeah, Forshaw class. It really was. Again, you look back, sometimes you don't know if you're looking back through rose-tinted glasses or with a bit of nostalgia, but you look back at the environment as it was then, that Brian Smith and then Matt Elliott and then Nobby continued. And I reckon you put it against any culture and environment to this day and it'd be hard pushed to beat it. The players that you had there, people like Forsh, were incredibly professional. They were doing things that were well ahead of the time. I mean, now with sports science being so prevalent in the game, things like prehab, you have your prehab, your rehab, your screenings, your well-being, et cetera, and everybody who plays now, that's just common terminology, whereas back then it wasn't. You know, there was still probably a big drinking culture in the game and things like that, and sports science, it wasn't really even... there weren't words that were uttered too much. That came in later, but all these players like Forsh were so professional. They were doing things like what players do now, just off their own backs. Just they were going out, researching it, knowing what works, learning their own bodies. Obviously, we had a very good S&C team with Carl Jennings there at that time as well. And they were class. Like I just, as a young kid, I remember coming into the squad and 16, 17, and looking around and thinking, well, you know, what am I going to have to do to get into this team? I've got probably two or three people in front of me in my position who are all internationals. They're either playing for Australia, New Zealand, Great Britain, whoever, Forsh included. And you're just thinking, what am I going to have to do to try and get in this team and earn the respect? So it's, well, I'll just do what's within my control. I'll try and be first in gym in the morning. I'll try and be last to leave. I'll try and do everything right while I'm at work, away from work, etc. And you turn up at gym and Forsh had been there already. Danny Gartner had been there already. JP had been there. Brian Mack. And they were just such great role models at that time, as I say, to learn from and pick the brains. And then eventually when you get to take the field with them, it's, again, that's a whole different level again that you've got to try and get used to.
Let's take you back to 2002, Jamie. You know, you've worked really hard. You've tried to impress Matt Elliott, Brian Noble, trying to establish yourself in that Bradford team. And you get the nod to make your debut at Valley Parade. And I think... correct me if I'm wrong, Bradford put 11 tries on Wakefield and it was like 60 points to 10.
I think you could be right, mate, yeah. I don't think I got too long in that game. I've only got a few minutes at the end and then I actually got my second game against Wakefield at Bellevue, got a bit longer. But yeah, it felt like a long time coming, really. But I suppose when you're a young kid and you're impatient, and that's what a young 17, 18-year-old lad and I'd seen, players like Leon Price, who were just unbelievable, really. Debut at 16, Chev Walker, Rob Burrow, Danny Maguire, lads who were always a little bit ahead of me in terms of like school age. And they were all starting to make the debuts at Leeds. So you do start to get a little bit ahead of yourself and you're thinking, oh, you know, when's my opportunity going to come? But you need to just sort of sit back and be patient. The team we had at Bradford at that time were unbelievable. As I said before, you probably... Your numbers 1 to 20, take your pick. They were all playing international from various countries around the world. And I just probably had to be a little bit patient at that time. I had fantastic coaching set up at Bradford throughout the academy with Daryl Shelford and Bernard Dwyer, Bernard were unbelievable, really, as a player and a coach. I couldn't thank him enough for what he did for me as a young lad and that I'd learnt so much from him. And I think approaching that debut, yeah, a little bit nervous, but yeah, I felt like I was ready. I'd probably achieved all I could achieve at that academy level at that time, and or played for my country, and And I felt like I was ready to take that next step. Whether I want or not, it's a different question. But yeah, I do remember getting out there, and you do feel like you probably need to try and impress. And it's sometimes not the best way to go about things. I think now if you give advice to any young players, you don't have to worry about going out there and breaking any pots and doing anything special. It's just go out there and do your job. That's how you earn the trust and the respect of your teammates around you and the senior players. Just go out there, work hard, and do the job that's expected of you. I probably tried to do a little bit too much. Tried to force the pass a little bit. And I remember Scott Naylor I think I'd tried to force an offload. Probably didn't appreciate the context of the game too much. And we might have been defending it on a hot day, defending a couple of back-to-back sets. And I've got the ball, first carry. Thought, well, I need to try and do something here. And tried an offload. Didn't come off. I think turned possession over. And I just remember Scott just coming over from his side of the field. And he just put his arm around me. He just says, look, mate, come on. He just says, you don't need to try too hard here. He just says, just do your job. That's all you need to do. Just do your job. Don't try too hard and you'll be fine. And I think from that moment on then, I just relaxed into the game. Everything happened so fast. Maybe that's the thing that you probably don't appreciate from watching the sidelines. That step up from academy and reserves to first team is huge. And everything just happened so quick around you. So physically, I was a biggish kid at 18, probably a similar size to I am now. So physically, I know I'd be all right, but it just happens at the speed of the pass, the ball, the lines of run, everything happening in front of you, the deception of the players. So that takes a while to get used to, but I think once you get used to that, you start to feel so much more confident in yourself and comfortable. But yeah, it seems like a lifetime ago now, does that.
You made your debut against Wakefield. You then established yourself in the side. What would you say was the breakthrough moment for Jamie Langley when it clicked upstairs and you thought, hang on a second, I'm getting my chance now. I'm making this loose forward position my own. What would you say the breakthrough moment was of your career?
It probably would have been, it's hard to pin it down to one game, but I'll try my best. I think I debuted at 18, as you said. I think at 19, 20, 21, I was so fortunate to be amongst a team of great players that we had at Bradford at that time and share some of the success that they'd built. You know, as a young kid, you're just kind of along for the ride, really, at that stage. So I was playing probably a bit part role. I think Nobby saw me as more of an impact player at that stage. And I played a lot of games off the interchange, and I sometimes come on after about 20 minutes when teams were getting a little bit fatigued or we might have put a bit of a dint in them, and he'd probably bring me on because I had a little bit of pace at that time, believe it or not. So probably bring me on, put me on an edge outside Deeks or inside Chantaine or around that area, and you knew they could create a bit of space. And that's kind of the role that they were trying to utilise me with then. So I was a little bit bigger. I could carry a bit more weight at that stage. Probably wasn't as fit. So I played probably 30, 40 minutes, either starting games or coming off interchange. And I probably did that until I was about 21 years old, leading up to the 2005 Grand Final. I remember coming off the bench in that game after about 15, 20 minutes. And then I think I played maybe the remainder of that game. And that was my role within the team. Obviously, we had a very, very good team. But at the end of 2005, as it's obviously well documented, we lost a lot of quality players. A lot of players moved on at that stage, and we recruited a few players in. But I thought, well, this could be an opportunity now for me. I mean, I was still on a young. Don't get me wrong, I was still 21, going 22 that next season. But I really saw that as an opportunity to try and stake more of a claim for a position. So we ended up playing West Tigers in the World Cup Challenge at the start of 2006 season. And going into the team run, I was due to be coming off the bench again. And Chris McKenna, I think, was starting at 13. We just signed Chris from Leeds the previous year. And he was due to start at 13. And he had a niggling hamstring injury or maybe something like that. And he failed his fitness test the day before the game. So Nobby came over and he said, I'm going to give you a start. So are you ready for it? And I'm like, yeah, obviously jumping at mid. World Cup Challenge, West Tigers, best team in the world, etc. So yeah, that was my first real start in a big game as such in that World Cup Challenge, and fortunately I managed to have a decent match with the game where Stu Fielden was absolutely phenomenal, unbelievable,
unbelievable. Looking back,
Stu at that time, there's no arguments or There's no question about it. For me, he was untouchable. He was the best front rower in the world for a period of time during that stage. And he were unbelievable that day. And I managed to start 13 and say, Lynch, you want to be good mate, Andy Lynch. He were unfortunate to miss out on the 2005 Grand Final. He started in the front row as well because we'd obviously lost JP and a couple more influential players in those positions. So, yeah, managed to step up and have a pretty good game in that game. And as I say, Nobby came afterwards and he said, oh, he did really well today, so I'm proud of you. And managed to give me a start for round one. And I never looked back. I just thought, well, you know, I've worked really hard to get to this position. Yeah, I'm still pretty young, but I felt like I was good enough at that time. And I just thought, well, it's mine to lose now, is this position. So I kind of transitioned, changed my game. I had to evolve my game a little bit from being probably that impact player who came off the bench and probably were there to try and break the game or score a try or something like that. Whereas playing at 13, I went from playing probably maybe 30, 40 minutes a game to playing 80 minutes. So I played 80 minutes loose forward, so I had to lose a bit of weight, trim down a little bit. And I really enjoyed that as well, being that player who your teammates could hopefully rely on, do a bit of the dirty work around the middle, a bit of the clean-up work, take some tough carries, you know, help out around the ruck, slow the rucks down if you need to. And I really prided myself on that, on being that hard worker who could punch out 80 minutes week in, week out and hopefully do the right things by his teammates. So, yeah, to evolve my game a little bit. But that's probably the turning point, I reckon, with that World Cup challenge, I think. And from that point forward then, yeah, I really tried to pin down that loose forward role.
Talk us through the 2005 season, Jamie, because I can pinpoint it as a supporter. It was a baking hot Sunday afternoon against Wakefield at Bellevue, and Wakefield had absolutely put the cleaners through us. And I think we'd lost by 54 points to 30. It was a real baking hot afternoon, a high scoring game. But from that moment, you know, I'm not sure what was said in that dressing room afterwards by Brian Noble, but after that game away against Wakefield, Bradford then go on an 11-game unbeaten run, which obviously sees the club beat St Helens away. I mean, how did that feel, you know, to finally get one over St Helens in a knockout game? And then you go on at Old Trafford to beat Leeds and you win the Super League Grand Final from third. You know, what was the catalyst? Am I on the right lines that there were so many players who were leaving the club that you had a reflective inward look at yourselves?
Possibly. It's a funny old game, this sport, really. And people throw the word momentum around a lot, don't they? And you think, well, what is momentum? How can I harness this magical word, momentum? But yeah, that's certainly what occurred that year. I think, above all else, Mick, I think it's just a testament to the players that we had in the club at that time, the leaders amongst that group. And again, take your pick from 1 to 17. You got your Robbies, JPs, your Leons, your Stu Fieldings, Joe Vergara, Shonies, Lezers, Yestin Harris there at that time, Paul Deacon, unbelievable. It's just the list is endless of the amount of quality players and people that the club had at that time. And you almost felt like if they decided to really turn it on and commit that we were good enough to do anything and achieve anything, really. And I'm not saying that's what happened, because it was a tough season there. I think we got out of the blocks. We got beat by Widnes away round one, possibly. I might be wrong. And then I think we lost the first two games. We actually played Wigan away round three. We probably had a crisis meeting going into that game. And it was a massive game, because you don't really want to start a season where you potentially, as you said earlier, one of the front runners to be 0-3, putting a lot of pressure on yourself. So we were actually behind in that game. And I just remember that was probably one of the best individual performances I've seen from a leader in that game, from JP. He was really stepping up as a leader at that time and transitioning from being obviously a quality player, international player, but he was really starting to model himself as a leader amongst the group at that time. And he was phenomenal. I just remember him getting back behind the ball, play 1-2 every set. He must have took about 40 carries. Like just the trademark JP, really, what he went on for later on in his career. And we ended up getting over the top of Wigan in that game. And then, yeah, like you said, a bit topsy-turvy from that point forward. But I think there were a couple of factors, really. I think, yeah, we did get a bit of momentum going forward. But we brought in Ian Henderson, if you remember.
I remember Ian Henderson.
Yeah, so we'd lost Jimmy Lowes. Obviously, such a pivotal part of the team was Jimmy. It might have been at the end of 2003, possibly, when Jimmy decided to call it.
After the grand final.
Yeah, and as you know, Jim was one of the best. Unbelievable, and especially within that environment. And then we never really properly replaced Jim. I think Robbie ended up covering at nine a little bit, but we never really had the out-and-out nine in his team until we brought Endo back in. And I think probably that sort of do-or-die circumstance, like you said earlier, it's like, well, it's now or never. We're going to have to turn it on, boys, or we can kiss the season goodbye. That probably... added with bringing Hendo in, who were brilliant for us for them few seasons. So you had a specialist nine in there who could then play off the back of probably arguably the best pack in the league at that time. So any quick play of the balls, obviously, we're able to exploit that in all the way that Hendo can. And I think just them couple of things, really, and the lads really, really getting together. And then we brought Moz in as well. If you remember, we brought Adrian in for the last few games of that season. He'd just been on the back of a grand final win with the Roosters. So that gave the team a massive boost as well, bringing someone in of Moz's quality, probably one of the top three, four front rowers in the world at that time still. So all them little ingredients there just all led to us really flicking the switch and swinging that momentum of that season. And it's funny sometimes when you play sport, sometimes you just, when you get that momentum behind you, you feel like you can't lose. You just feel like you're going into games on such high spirits and high on confidence, you just feel like you can't lose. And I vividly remember the weeks leading up to that Saints game in the semi-final and the grand final as well against Leeds, and how relaxed the players were the 2 weeks leading up to those two games. I remember players breaking PBs in the gym, lifting heavier weights than they had done all season and the whole life even. And there was that feel-good factor around the place. It just felt like it was not fate as such, but it just felt like there were no way we could have lost them games. And as it transpired, we didn't. But yeah, it's a funny old thing, it's sport, as I say. But I think that those factors, probably that, yeah, bringing the boys together, just thinking, right, it's now or never. The leaders in the group, you know, take your pick. So many unbelievable leaders in that group who could turn it on when they wanted. And then bringing Hendo in as a specialist nine. I think you put all those things together, and that's probably what flicked the switch for us that year.
You've worked under so many great coaches, Jamie. Which one would you say, if it's possible to even pick one, would you say you've looked up to the most and you've learnt the most from?
Yeah, again, it's a great question, is that, Mick? And it's probably a difficult one to answer because I have been really fortunate, as you say, to work under and with and alongside some fantastic coaches. I think probably one of the key parts in anybody's career and life, more importantly, are them informative years when you're really starting to develop your beliefs, your values, what's important to you as a person. And that can probably happen at those younger years. And I'm fortunate to be around some fantastic coaches and players around that time as well. As a young 16, 17-year-old lad, we had obviously Matty Elliott. Well, I worked very briefly with Matty. We were there for a year and I was still in the academy, so I didn't spend too much time with him. But all the players, all the first team boys, spoke very, very highly of him. They all looked up to him. And then obviously I had Nobby as reserves coach who stepped up there. Nobby were a fantastic coach as well, and he really took us all under his wing as young players. He kind of took it upon himself and his responsibility to mentor us and really show us what it took to be a Bradford football, you know, instill that culture into us, what it means to be in this environment, what it means to be a Bradford football, but more importantly, what characteristics and values you're going to have to display as a person if you want to come and be part of this organisation. I remember one of the first times I went there, I had a polo shirt on with my collar were up because I think it was a sunny day and I was getting sunburn on my neck. And we were sat inside having some food and Nobby's come over and he's turned the collar down and he says, no, we don't do that here, son. You know, we're an hard-working team. It was just kind of that, just always reminding you that's what we're about here. These are the values you want you to display. So when you're at that young age, a lot of those things they do rub off on you. And as I mentioned earlier, Bernard Dwyer coached me at academy level. And Bernard were unbelievable. He just had the utmost respect for him as a player, how tough he was. I mean, the bloke he played, I think it was a Challenge Cup final, it might be at Murrayfield, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, it wasn't.
He tore one of his biceps in the first 10 minutes. It might have been his left bicep off the bone in the first 10 minutes. And they've tried to drag him off, and he said, no, I'm not. He said, this could be the last final ever played. There's no way I'm leaving this field. Staying out there like only Bernard could. And then he tore his other bicep off bone. Tore both his biceps off bone. Anyone who's had a muscle strain knows how painful it can be. He's running about in a Challenge Cup final with no biceps. They just could not get him off the field. That's how tough Bernard was. Incredibly humble. Just the most humble, modest bloke you'd ever meet. And again, the lessons that you learn from these people coming up in those informative years are so influential. And then, obviously, coming through, I worked under Nobby for a lot of years, Steve Mack, who brought a lot of different skill sets to the table as a coach as well. So you pick little bits from there. And then fast forward then to probably when I started coaching career. I worked under Andrew Henderson for a year and now working alongside Danny Ward. And every single coach, they're all different. They've all got different aspects what made them good as coaches. And they might be characteristics or personal attributes. They might be from a tech standpoint. So you're always learning different things from different coaches and players that you play alongside and players that you coach as well. You're always going to be open to learn. I think the key is that you have got to be incredibly open-minded, and then you've got to have a strong philosophy yourself, and you've always got to put the lessons that you've learned, because the environments that you've been through and the people that you spend the most time with, they're the ones that generally shape your belief systems, whether it be your parents growing up, your best mates who you knock about with, the coaches, as I say, you spend time with in your informative years. They form the majority of your belief systems and the way you view the world. I think the key is when you get a bit older then and you've got to recognise that you've got to put those belief systems to the test. You've got to put them in question all the time, constantly question, why do I believe this? Why do I think this way? Why do I think this is the right way? Is there another better way of doing this? And that's, I think, one of the keys to being a good coach and always doing. But, yeah, like I say, it's difficult to pin down one specific coach. I've learned so much from every single one of them, and I'm grateful for all the time that I got to spend with each and every single one of them as well, because they have, as I said, they formed a lot of my belief systems that I have to this day.
What made that Bradford Bulls you've set up so successful, Jamie? Because obviously following on from the likes of yourself, Stuart Radin, Leon Price, Stuart Field and Paul Deacon, you then had Sam Burgess, Tom Burgess, George Burgess, Elliot Whitehead, James Donaldson, John Bateman, Danny Addy, Adam O'Brien, all players now who have either tasted the greatest success at Super League level or the NRL, as is the case with the Burgess, Whitehead, and Bateman. What made that Bradford youth set up so successful?
I think, again, it's difficult to pinpoint one exact thing, but what I'd probably put it down to, Mick, are the culture that the club had in place. I think everything starts with the philosophy and the culture that the leaders have got to try and implement. And fortunately, we had a string of great coaches coming through at that time, not just at the top level, at first team level, but all the way through reserves, academy. You look at the coaches that have come through that system from when Matty Elliott were there. You had Brian Noble, then you had Steve Mack, you had Carl Harrison, Jimmy Lowe's, Phil Vivas, and then beneath that, you had people like Mark Robinson. Not just at top level, but all the way throughout. You had a very strong, clear philosophy that were driven from the top down. You had a very, very good culture in place. The standards were incredibly high. As I say, I look back on those days at Bradford now, and we'd have been doing things within that organisation that clubs aren't doing to this day. The standards were that high. And I can say that in great confidence, I know, because you work within different organisations and different environments and you speak to players at different places. And I know what we were doing then were head and shoulders above probably a lot of clubs at that time. And I just think that culture that you're being brought through as a young player, the standards that are in place, the people, again, it all comes back to the people. just having great people there with great attributes, great characteristics, who are able to instill those values and characteristics within you as a young man, essentially, and show you the correct way of going about things. This is the way we do things here. These are the attributes and the values that we feel are important to enable us to be successful. And everybody just buys into it. Everybody buys into it, and that's what happened. And that's when you can get an environment and a culture right like that, it shows how much success you can have. And as I say, I look back on those days at Bradford fondly and take a lot of things from there because of the things that were in place and the things that the club were doing at that time. But so many great people, Mick, as you know, like from all the way from the coaching staff to the behind the scenes, to the groundsman, to the office staff. It were an unbelievable environment to be involved in, and just some of the best people you ever meet in your life were working in the club at that time, and I think that's what enabled it to be so successful.
Towards the end of your rugby league career, Jamie, you moved from back row to prop. How did you approach that move, and was it a reluctant step you had to take?
It's obviously you've always got to look to try and evolve your game and change. And I think as I was getting a little bit older, a few injuries creep up with you. You probably slow down a little bit. That was just probably a natural progression. I think the way the game were moving at that time, the loose forward role had probably transitioned a little bit into that third middle now, which you'll see. And it's swinging back a little bit now, actually, with the less interchange. Obviously, the interchange going down, you need that loose forward now to probably punch out a lot more minutes. So it's probably swinging back again to what it would have been like 20 years ago, and then probably 20 years before that. It's a copycat sport, really, isn't it? And we're always going swings and roundabouts with these things. But as I was probably coming towards the end of my career, and you were looking at probably 12 to 10 interchange, I think it might have been at that time, you could afford to use that 13 essentially as an extra front rower. So you'd have three big blokes out there. There were no need to have a 13 out there who could punch out 80 minutes and do that sort of a job. And you could have probably two blokes doing 40 minutes and providing you with much more impact. So I think that's probably the way that the game was swinging at that moment in time. And that's probably where I was seen at that time within the team. I don't know if my game were best suited to that impact style of play. I'm not too sure if I was just better off just kind of being left out there and let me punch out the minutes. But I fully appreciate that you've got to change with the times. I think it certainly put a few more miles on my clock, so to speak. Punching out minutes in the middle there. Obviously, you're going through a lot more collisions when you're in the middle. Your body's under a lot more duress, and as I say, the injuries eventually just crept up with me. Probably where I wasn't able to compete at a level of competition or hold myself to certain standards that I always held myself at throughout my career. So I think you sort of come to a stage as a player, you'd like to think you can, but you'd like to go out on your terms. And you've also got to recognise, I think, when that right time is as well. And as I say, I was getting to that stage in my career where I probably just weren't able to attain the standards and achieve that level of play that I know I'm capable of. That's probably what was more difficult to try and accept that. I think as a player, you always hold yourself to certain standards. And as a human being as well, you've got a level of pride there. And I think just trying to accept that, you're probably not quite as good as you once were and able to achieve those standards, and you've probably got to be realistic with yourself and look to the next chapter.
After a glittering career, Jamie, at the Bradford Bulls, where you spent practically, if you from your academy days right up to leaving for Hulkingston Rovers in 2013, you know, half a generation you spent at the club. You know, just talk us through, you know, 2013 and, you know, all that financial turmoil and your decision to move on from the club.
Yeah, it were a tough time. It were a tough time for a lot of people involved at Bradford. I think, as you say, the club had gone through such a period of sustained success, and then slowly just started to fade over a number of years. That culminated in then the club obviously going into administration when Potsy were the coach. And we actually did really well that year. I think we would have made the playoffs had it not been for the points deduction.
That's correct.
Which were unfortunate. I think Potsy picked up the coach of the year as well that year. So it were an interesting time, but we learned a lot about ourselves as players, as individuals. You kind of learn what's important as well, what works when it comes to training, to the day to day, to the scheduling, et cetera, because we had a lot of time off that year. I think Mick were really good with us. Obviously, the psychological duress of having to deal with being in and out of administration, not getting answers from the RFL. We didn't know where we stood as players. I think we were going into one game. Believe it or not, we're going into one game. It might have been on Friday night. Wigan away, we actually won. We actually went and beat them. But I think the day before, on that Thursday, we just had a team run. Or we might not have even had a team run. We might have just said, I think because the coaches, I don't know if the coaches weren't able to be at training even. I think they'd stood down at that time. So Potsy and Franny were there at that time. They weren't even there. So I think we decided as a leadership group, we said, well, I'm going to carry on with this team, but I'm going to go and have an hour down at pub with coaching staff. So myself and Disco and a few other lads got together and we said, well, we'll kick a ball about for a bit and then we'll go and meet Potsy and Franny and what have you down at pub the day before the game. So we've all decided to do that. And then somebody raised the question. They said, are we even insured for this game? If we go out there and play and get injured, are we even insured? So I made a phone call to RFL and they said, well, no, you're not insured even. The insurance has not been paid, so it says, well, if that's the case, then we're reluctant to go out and play. So this was probably 3 o'clock on Thursday afternoon. We've got Wigan away on Friday night, and I think Disco were doing all the liaising with it might have been Ralph at that time at RFL, and Disco just said, look, he said, as it stands, Rob, he said, we're not going to play this game. He said, unless we're insured to go out there as players. Put us bodies on line. We're not going to play. So that sort of circulated around the players, and we all agreed, and we all stood strong. And I think it might have been, it went after midnight that night, so it could have even been into early hours of the morning. I think Disco finally got a message or a call from the RFL saying, right, we've managed to sort insurance out for you. You can go and play. So What a bit crazy at that time. So obviously we had to text around Friday morning, date game, right, lads, game's on. And then we went to Wigan and beat them at JJB against all the odds. They're the sort of game, you don't really remember too many games from your career, it all just sort of blends in. But I do remember that one very vividly because of the circumstances. But yeah, as you say, what a tough time, mate, a tough time to be involved at the club at that time. And I'd have loved to have stayed at Bradford, I really would. And I made that very clear. I'd love to have finished my career there. I loved it, as I said to you earlier, from day one, from that first game going along with mum and dad and watching Bradford and Salford on a Friday night. And I was hooked from that moment forward. And I always just envisioned myself finishing my career there. But I totally understand the business side of the game. And I fully appreciate that as well. And you've got to balance your squad. You've got to balance the books. And it was probably that stage then where, I mean, I'd love to have stayed, but it probably wasn't right for the club to have kept me on. So that's when the decision was made that I'd end up leaving and going to Hull KR, as you said.
Who would you say is the toughest opponent you have faced out there on that rugby league field?
I was fortunate to play against Andy Farrell a couple of times, and he was, before he left to rugby union, when he was at Wigan. So I probably played against Faz a few times, and he was incredibly difficult to play against. I think just his physical stature, a big bloke, a lot bigger than you thought. On telly sometimes, you don't appreciate how big some of these lads are. I mean, you'll know yourself, Nick, when you stand next to players. There's some lads that really surprise you. And Faz was a big bloke. He was like 6'4", 6'5", strong, powerful, difficult to tackle, very, very, very competitive. So just always into everything, and just his ability to get the best out of his team as well. You know, we're always going to be a tough day at office, and you'd certainly put Paul Sculthorpe in that bracket as well. Again, a mountain of a man, incredibly competitive, difficult to play against, never stopped for 80 minutes, and a very good skill set as well. So I think I probably put them two in that bracket because they were in a similar position to me, and you were always comparing yourself against those players, obviously, who were in similar positions to you across the league. I'd put Gareth Ellis into that bracket. Gaz is another one who's, again, an incredible player, incredibly competitive, never stopped for 80 minutes. Everything he did, from a tech-tag standpoint of view, were immaculate, and he was very aggressive and physical, and he used to really try and impose himself on the game as well. So, yeah, those three probably within that position. And then, again, a lot of lads, when you used to ask lads this when we were playing at Bradford, they'd probably all answer the same question. They'd all say Stuart Fielden in training were probably the toughest opponent that they'd face, because they say we had such a good side there, so many good players, who were all ultra-competitive. And Stu were probably just a little bit more competitive than everybody else. So you knew that whatever you were going to go against in training, it was going to be tougher than what you faced on a weekend 9 times out of 10, because you'd been through it against Stu, against Baloo, against Big Joe, against your JPs, your Radders, your Forshers. You'd been through ringer with them all week, so coming up against them, it didn't matter who you were facing on a weekend, because you probably weren't going to get it any tougher than what you were going to get it then.
Obviously, since retiring from rugby league in 2015, when you finished your career at Sheffield, you was then appointed the head coach of the academy at London. You're now the assistant coach, still working heavily with James Ford, Paul Anderson, Dave Elliott, and the RFL on the England academy setup. But what, normally I'd ask, if it was a player who I was doing this with, I'd ask, you know, what are the hopes, you know, for the remainder of your career and your future? But obviously you've retired now. So what are your hopes for the future in a coaching sense? Do you aspire to be a head coach following on from what Matt Diskin's doing now, what Brian Noble did, Mick Potter, Steve McNamara? And I guess the second part of this question is, would you one day like to be the man at the helm at the Bradford Bulls?
It's a very good question, is that, Mick? But it's a tough one to answer, really. I mean, I think every coach, well, no, probably tell a lie there, not every coach has aspirations to be a head coach. I've known coaches and I've worked alongside coaches throughout my career who've been incredible assistant coaches, but never had aspirations to be a head coach for whatever reason, personal to them. I don't know. It's a very different dynamic, obviously. Being a head coach to an assistant coach. I'm incredibly fortunate with the position that I'm in now. They pretty much give me full autonomy of the programme from a coaching perspective. Powell is the head of youth there, and obviously there were a lot of steep learning curve for me from the administrative side and things like that. But from a coaching perspective, they just said, you made this your own, Langers. So I'm incredibly fortunate to be able to do that. And I love that aspect of it. As well, there's a lot more to coaching than meets the eye. You know, from the tech point of view to the philosophical point of view to the psychological point of view, you've got to wear so many hats as a coach, and I really love it. I just love coaching, love everything about it, really, to be honest. And working alongside Wardy, I think, as I say, I am incredibly fortunate, because I think Wardy's strengths, above all else, as a coach, are his authenticity, and his ability to put trust in his staff. We've got a great S&C department, a great medical department, and the amount of autonomy and trust that Wardy gives me as a coach, it probably affords me more than, dare I say, any other public coach out there, really. We work great together. You know, I'm forever grateful for the opportunity he gave me and to work alongside him as well. So that itch to go and pursue other positions and things like that, it's not quite there, because I get on so well with him and we work so well together. Hopefully he'd reciprocate that. I don't know if he would. but yeah, I'm incredibly grateful to be able to work alongside him in that capacity. So I don't know if that answers your question entirely, but that's probably the best I can phrase it, really. As I say, I am grateful every day that I get to go to work and do a job that I absolutely love, I'm incredibly passionate about, I'm incredibly fortunate to have. to work alongside some fantastic players as well, fantastic people, more importantly. I couldn't be any more fortunate, really. So I don't try and look too far ahead in the future. Just try and concentrate on where we are now, and what can I do? What can I contribute to this organisation, to this team? How can I help the players? Because essentially, that's what you're there for as a coach. You're there to help the players, no more and no less. You're there to help them get the best out of themselves and help them perform to the best of their ability. So if I can do that, then that's a massive tick in the box for me as a coach. Don't try and look too far ahead. Just try and enjoy every single moment.
So thank you very much to Jamie Langley for his Bradford Bulls in Conversation. Coming up next in the Bradford Bulls in Conversation hot seat will be former Bradford Bulls player Ross Peltier.